We now move to chapter 2, and the text, the verses, I'm selecting verses to run you through it, verse 1, 7 and 14, you can see that, and it reads like, but it is all the text. It says, "We journeyed back into the wilderness on the way to the Red Sea." Can you imagine that map now again? "As Yahweh had told me, and we skirted Mount Seir," that's the really high mountains in Edom, that south part, "for many days." See Seir? Okay. "Surely Yahweh your God has blessed you," says Moses, "in all your undertakings. He knows you're going through this great wilderness. These 40 years Yahweh your God has been with you, you have lacked nothing." So Moses is speaking at the end of the 40 years, of course. "The length of time we had travelled from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Wadi Zered," or the Zered Gorge, more likely, would be a better translation, "was 38 years, until the entire generation of warriors had perished from the camp." So, from Kadesh Barnea, the way here, going around here, there's the Wadi Zered at the bottom of Moab on the east side of the Dead Sea. So, took 38 years. So there's where that's where the Deuteronomic community place the events that we're going to read about, the stories we're going to read about. Oh, that would have been an easier way to do it. Same map. All those references are just to the text. You don't have to worry about that. They're in Deuteronomy where they're mentioned. Deuteronomy 2, verse 24 and the following. "Proceed on your journey and cross the Wadi Arnon. See, I have handed over to you King Sihon the Amorite of Heshbon and his land. Begin to take possession by engaging him in battle." There's the Wadi Zered at the bottom of Moab. There's the Wadi Arnon at the north. So it's that little section there on this side of the Dead Sea. And the king of that area, we've just heard, is King Sihon at Heshbon. "King Sihon of Heshbon wasn't willing to let us pass through, for Yahweh your God had hardened his spirit." What's that remind you of? Pharaoh. Yahweh. Well, you see, in their logic, get into their logic, because you've got to look at it, understand it, and then, I think, withdraw from it. Their logic is, if his heart was hardened, Yahweh does everything in the world, so Yahweh must have hardened it. Do you see? That's the logic. Yahweh must have hardened Pilate's heart to make him condemn Jesus to death, because Yahweh must have hardened the high priest's heart so he would condemn him. Yahweh must have hardened the soldiers. Yahweh must have done all that because it happened. Do you get me? I think we have to withdraw from that logic. I have to. I presume you might have to too. To realize that Yahweh, in making us free, has actually taken our freedom seriously. And therefore, we are capable, this is all Thomas Aquinas too, by the way, so it's not just me, we're capable of sinning and making decisions that are contrary to God's will. And God allows that, or makes us in such a way that we're able to do it. "Hardened his spirit, made his heart defiant in order to hand him over to you." There's the purpose, because there was a battle. I'm not saying historically there was a battle. In fact, I'm going to say there wasn't. But this is the story. "As he has now done, when Zion came out against us, Yahweh our God gave him over to us, and we struck him down along with his offspring and all his people In each town of Moab, we utterly destroyed men, women, and children, and we left not a single survivor. Hooray! They all cheer. And it's all God organising this, which means that the people who wrote it thought like that. The people who read it thought like that. The people who preserved it as wise thought like that. So I'm hoping I'm helping you read the Bible with care. Always read it through the eyes of Jesus. It was said to you of old, but I say to you, love your enemies. Love your enemies. So it's really deep and very important to. Otherwise, we'll end up not being free. We'll end up being trapped. Left not a single survivor. Chapter 3 now, verse 3 and 8, tells us the rest of the story. So can you see Zered Gorge and Arnon there, and Moab here? Okay, well now we're going to journey up this side. Yahweh our God also handed over to us King Og of Bashan, right up the north there, the Sea of Galilee. And all his people, we struck him down until not a single survivor was left. Heroic, sounds good, everybody cheers. At that time we took from the two kings of the Amorites the land beyond the Jordan, from Wadi Arnon to Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is just up north of Bashan, or northwest of Bashan. The account of the conquering of Transjordan, which we've just done in a very brief bit, seems to be an imaginative retrojection into the wilderness period. Now, I don't know whether I invented the word retrojection or it's a real word, because the dictionary doesn't have it. But it makes a retrojection is to. Have I invented it? It's just. And the, yeah, projection, retrojection. But anyhow, I think my dictionary came up with those funny little squiggles you get in the. And when you're typing these things and it tells you you've wrongly spelled it, and then I went to the dictionary and couldn't find it. And I thought, oh, well. Anyhow, so I'm sticking with it. As long as you know what I mean. An imaginative retrojection into the wilderness period of 10th century Israelite military victories. So it seems likely that in the 900s, and now we're in the time of David and Solomon, so we're 250 years later historically. So I'm suggesting to you that there were historical, well, we know, in fact, from archaeology and so on. So there were battles over in this area in the 900s, in the 10th century, well before this is written, 400 years before it's written. And so I'm suggesting to you that Moses' story has this, because they want it to be in the beginning, they want it to be part of the beginning. So it's all put back into these times. Because in fact, in Deuteronomy 3, 12 to 20, the Transjordan, and I won't read it for you, is given over to these tribes, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. So they're the three there. Families of the Manasseh. So three of the tribes are settled there because they were there later. Do you get it? 300 years later, there were Israelites on this side of the Jordan, which is not part of the Promised Land, because Moses doesn't go into the Promised Land, and he's still here. So it's not part of the Promised Land. Why are we here? Because we were given the Promised Land. What are we doing over there? Oh, well, we were there because Moses, before he went into the Promised Land, God organized it so that you could be there. Great. So you own it. You can build your settlements on it. No matter what Obama says, stick to your guns and stay with Netanyahu and keep ruining the country. That's the kind of logic of it. So, but the condition that they got it, according to the story, is they've got to go over and fight with their brothers in the Promised Land. And that's all told you there. Now we come to. So that's introductory. I'm suggesting introductory. Now we're coming to the introduction to the book of Deuteronomy. So they've given us a quick historical back and forward view. Now we're beginning again, really, in chapter 4. It's a beautiful chapter. It has a special place, and I conclude with chapter 4, in the book of Deuteronomy. It continues to portray Moses as calling the people to look back and learn from their experiences. It's the first teaching sermon, not just a reminder of what's happened, but it's a sermon in brackets in Deuteronomy. It's a beautiful summary of the message of the whole book. Moses is teaching the people the lessons that they'll need to learn if they are to take possession of the land and remain in it. Read, the Deuteronomic writers in exile are teaching the exiles the lesson they'll have to learn so as not to repeat the destruction of Jerusalem and to go back into the promised land and really live it and inherit it. Chapter 4 is also looking forward, preparing the way for the following chapters, which summarise the essential elements of the revelation given to Moses on Sinai. Read Horeb, the wilderness mountain, beginning with the 10 words, the 10 commandments, which is our topic, by the way, for next week. We're just going to do chapter 5, basically, the 10 commandments section. Here is chapter 4. So now, Israel, give heed to the statutes, the edicts that I'm teaching you to observe, so that you may live and enter and occupy the land that Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, is giving you. You must neither add anything to the word that I command, nor take away anything from it, but keep the commandments of Yahweh, your God, with which I am charging you. Four words, and they appear all the way through the book of Deuteronomy. You'll also find them in other places. And there they were, statutes, hukim, edicts, mishpatim, word, davar, and commandments, mitzvot. They're the four Hebrew words. Can you see what I'm pointing to, can't you? Now, what's the difference between them? They've got different, slightly different nuances. I'd rather you read my commentary and work on all that. So they're different aspects of the one kind of reality. But they're also talking about different levels of it too. It's an attempt to see, because the most important ones are the word, Dabar, God's word. And there are, they don't talk about the Ten Commandments in this book. They talk about the 10 words. There are also a whole lot of statutes, edicts, and commandments. But the 10 are not. They're the words. They're actually written by God. Moses wrote the others from memory and from what God told him. So they've got a very special place in the tradition, the religious tradition, like the Beatitudes might have a special place for us and so on. He continues. What, and so this is very inclusive, this is including a whole lot. This is the Torah, including the Hukim, Mishpatim, Dabarim, and Mitzvot. All of those are part of the Torah in the Deuteronomic understanding. What other great nation has a God so near to it as Yahweh our God is whenever we call to him? What other great nation has statutes and edicts as just as the entire Torah that I'm setting before you today? And the Deuteronomy is about the entire Torah looked at spiritually and got to its essence by these wonderful writers, the Deuteronomic school. Verse 11 to 14 of chapter 4. You approached, you stood at the foot of the mountain while the mountain was blazing up to the very heavens, shrouded in dark clouds. That's the drama of Sinai. Then Yahweh spoke to you out of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form. You heard, you can't look at God with your eyes, but they heard the thunder. The voice of God on the mountains, shuddering and shattering the mountains. He declared to you his covenant, Berit, I will do this, you will do that, we're bound together, which he charged you to observe, that is the 10 words. and he wrote them on two stone tablets. He wrote them. These are very special. God wrote them on the tablets. We'll see next week that in other texts, Moses wrote them. So they're not saying God pulled out a biro. God, in other words, is responsible for them. And Moses is responsible for them. They were actually written down by somebody many years later, because Moses probably didn't read or write. There's no reason to think he did. And Yahweh charged me at that time to teach you the statutes, here's the word again, and the edicts, for you to observe in the land that you're about to cross into and occupy. So the 10 words are important, but so are the statutes and edicts, because they all make up the Torah. Obedience to God's will, in other words, is what's critical. Chapter 4 continues, selecting verses but giving you the bulk of it. Be careful not to forget the covenant that Yahweh your God made with you. Not to make for yourself an idol in the form of anything that Yahweh your God has forbidden you. Don't tie God down. Don't make an image of God. My memory. University chaplain. Lovely woman who had psychiatric problems in her earlier life and possibly still doing a course there, and we welcomed her into the community, as of course you would. And her way of contributing was to make little cloth things that you could put on the, just to make it look pretty, and that was her contribution, among others, but that was her contribution. And when she left the community, her husband, whom she'd met in a psychiatric place in Canada earlier, he came up with this gift because of the way we the community had welcomed her in, and though she gave us more than we gave her, which is always the case, and it was a crucifix, wooden crucifix. If you want to see it, it's at Douglas Park in our monastery chapel, not the big church, but because I put it there. So anyhow, he gave us this, and it doesn't look pretty. It's made out of really old wood, I'm told. It's from Victoria somewhere, and it's the next stage is brown coal. Like, it's really hard. Thousands of years old bit of wood, out of one wood. And he carved it, and he told me it's the exact image of the crucifix that was back in the Catholic place where he'd met his wife and married her. So it had a lot of going for it. So thoughtlessly, I have to say now, looking back, the Catholics, we were the ones that used the hall all the time. We had Mass every day, sometimes twice a day, lunchtime and after thing. But the Anglican community used to come in there, I think, once a week and give a talk, like not religious, just chat, talk. And the Anglican chaplain was there. So I had the crucifix behind the altar. It went missing, just vanished. Couldn't find it anywhere for about a month. Then it turned up in a cupboard. And I found out that he'd organised one of the Anglicans to take it out. And so I said, why? He said, oh, you're worshipping an idol. You're worshipping a piece of wood. And this is going to sound like kids in a schoolyard, but I can remember that I said, no, we're not worshipping. I said, I'm not worshipping the wood. I said, if you were dying of cold, freezing to death of cold, I'd give it to you to burn. I mean, it's only a piece of wood. But it is an image of Jesus on the cross. Oh, yeah, but you can't make images. You worshipping it. I said, no, we're not worshipping it. And he said, yes, you are. And I said, no, we're not. And then he said, yes, you are. And I thought, well, how does he know what I'm doing what's going on in this bloke's brain? But he was so convinced. So you know how you think you can win an argument and you try, and I've given up, I think. I said to him, well, look, I said, you like giving preaching, don't you? He said, oh, yes, he said. And I said, and you do it well, do you? Oh, yeah, very well. I said, you're using words, you're crafting words to speak about God. The person who did this crafted a piece of wood to speak about God. Why is one wrong and one right? Why are words, because we make words, aren't we? What? In fact, they're more dangerous. So, but it got nowhere. So then, and I then sensitively and correctly, I would put it up a mass and then take it down again, you know, so that he wouldn't have to look at it, because I thought that was right. And had I been wiser, I would have asked him first, do you mind? You know, but I didn't think of it. But I thought, here's someone who's supposed to be intelligent. He's the chaplain of the university. And by the way, that's not the only thing I had against him, if I could say that. Because when you heard him speak, it was brash. It was critical of the Catholics, of course, because, I mean, they're all critical of Catholics, and they can't understand why we've got over a billion of us in the world and it's such a stupid thing to be. But everyone seems to want to be it. And then we have the RCIA happening and people joining the church. But he was also critical of the Anglican Church. That he was critical of anything, I'd almost have to say, except himself. Like, he was critical of institutions, which is easy to be. I can be too, and usually it's a bit silly to be too critical of institutions. But back to our text. But why did I tell you that? I don't know, but I did. But look at the text. Be careful not to forget the covenant with Yahweh. Do not make for yourselves an idol in the form of anything. That's really important because, in other words, all the people around them had their idols. Now, they misunderstood them. They weren't worshipping the idol either. People don't. But it was a representation of the invisible spirit, you know. They weren't worshipping wood or goats or anything. They weren't worshipping the moon. And in fact, the moon tells me a little more about God than General Motors Holden, especially now. So, you know, what are you going to worship? But words are the same. We have to be careful of our words. Our words are only words. The church's words are only words. They point us towards the mystery and away from error, and that's just so important. That's why we've got to use our minds as far as we can. But they're not God. And the Bible isn't God. And the Catechism isn't God. And the Pope isn't God. Well, you know all this, but I'm not God either. Okay. Now that did surprise me. So, for Yahweh your God is a devouring fire, a jealous God. Jealous meaning zealous, a God that doesn't want us to give up and head in the wrong direction, but wants us to worship the real God, the mysterious, transcendent fire and cloud God. Yahweh will scatter you among the peoples, and that probably reminds you of the story of the ziggurat, which we did last week or whatever. From there you will seek Yahweh your God, and you'll find him if you search for him with all your heart and soul. That's beautiful, isn't it? In your distress, when all these things have happened to you, Moses is looking forward. Of course, the people who wrote it are looking back. Destruction of Jerusalem. But they see that Moses foresaw all this in the drama. Of course he didn't. When all these things have happened to you in time to come, you will return to Yahweh your God and you will heed him. Because Yahweh your God is a compassionate God. He will neither abandon you nor destroy you. He will not forget the covenant with your ancestors that he swore to them. Beautiful passage about God, and I don't think we can improve on it. I can't think of how you'd improve on that. And chapter 4 continues. So, acknowledge today and take to heart that Yahweh is God of heaven above and earth beneath. There is no other. Keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am commanding you today for your own well-being and that of your descendants after you, so that you may long remain in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you for all time. So be a Russian Jew, remember the pogroms that have gone on for centuries, be a Polish Jew, and remember how the Catholics loved you rather badly for a long time. You know, if only we lived Christianity, there'd only be Christianity, but we just don't live it, so there's a lot of other things around. Who wouldn't want to be a Christian if we actually lived it? But that's what we've got to get on with. So all of that's happening, and why did it happen? And they come back then after the Second World War. You're given Israel, which is a miracle. So some of them think it's theirs because God gave it to them for all time. So the people that are there have no right from God to be there. So of course Gaza shouldn't exist. Of course you shouldn't have a two-state solution. Of course the people living there have no right to be there. brackets, even though if you go back in time, I bet there are more people descended from the Jews among the Muslims than there are among the Jews who are from Europe and somewhere else. So who knows about that? But the logic of it is shattering. But you can see if you don't think and if you're locked into these texts in your viewpoint, why you could be, think like that, act like that. So this scripture study is critically important for the peace of the world as well as many other things. Chapter 4, verse 32, ask now about former ages, long before your own, ever since the day that God created human beings on the earth. Ask from one end of heaven to the other. Has anything so great as this happened, or has its like ever been heard of? Has any people ever heard the voice of God speaking out of a fire, as you have heard and lived on Mount Horeb? Or has any God ever tempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of other nations by trials, by signs, by wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by terrifying displays of power, as Yahweh your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes? Retrojecting stories back. To you it was shown so that you would acknowledge that Yahweh is God, there is no other beside him. Now, is that strict monotheism? Don't think so yet. It could be. I mean, it's heading that way, certainly. But it's more like saying everything's insignificant compared to. There's no woman in the world like you, darling. Doesn't mean your beloved is the only woman in Yarralumla. But in your eyes, she is. So that doesn't mean you're a mono, whatever you'd have to be to think there's only one woman in the world. But, you know, but it's, so it's a love statement and a wonderful statement. But it's we're at the beginning of this, if it's written during the exile, which we're at the beginning of that emerging idea of monotheism. But as I've said to you often before, monotheism is still very fragile. It wouldn't surprise me if I'm not a monotheist. I think I am, but I've never been put to the test. That you might be a monotheist, I don't know, but I wouldn't be sure, because the people, the Catholic Christians that sided with Hitler weren't monotheists, but they probably thought they were. The Jews at the Wailing Wall are not monotheists, but they might think they were. The Muslims who are bowing to the ground and saying there is only one God, Allah, and sending an 18-year-old girl into a marketplace to blow herself up and blow up innocent people, they're not monotheists. Because if you were a monotheist, if you thought there was only one God, immediately, necessarily, everyone is your brother and sister. Everyone. Because there's only one God. Where do they come from if not from God? And if they're not from God like you, then love one another. It has to be. So monotheism isn't just a theoretical answer to a question. It's a way of life. It's a conviction that the saints had, some of them, and it would be good for us to have. And I conclude this morning with you with the end verses of chapter 4. From heaven he made you hear his voice to discipline you, to teach you, to the way you teach your kids. Spare the rod and spoil the child. On earth he showed you his great fire while you heard his words coming out of the fire. And because he loved your ancestors, he chose their descendants after them. He brought you out of Egypt with his own presence by his great power, driving out before you nations greater and mightier than yourselves to bring you in and give you their land for a possession as it is still today. That's interesting. We're before we go in, aren't we? It looks like the editors have shown their hand a bit to me. They're clearly writing a lot later. And they are giving in Moses words that I'm not... It just looks to me as though the metaphor has slipped into reality a bit unawares, because it wasn't their possession yet. Do you get it? When Moses is speaking, it's still on the other side of the river. But that last verse seems to betray a later author, which is what it should do.